Welcome to MyTechnologyLawyer.com. This is your host, Scott Drawn, streaming live from beautiful Ponte Vedra Beach this afternoon where they play the Players' Championship. We've got sunshine galore. We're living up to our reputation as the sunshine state. It's actually quite hot outside, I must say. We'd love to have you be on our program, and you can do so by calling in toll-free. Price is right. 866-685-7469. That's 866-MTL-SHOW. If you're not quite ready for your radio debut, you're not quite ready to get on the line with us, you can still communicate and get your message across by sending me an email, radio@mytechnologylawyer.com. I monitor the emails as they come in. You got a gripe, you got an issue, got a question, you want to ask our geek a question, you've got a comment about cyber terrorism, which is the topic of today's show, well, you can sure make your presence felt and known by sending me an email. I get questioned from time to time. People ask me, well, if I send an email, do you use my name on the show? Not if you don't want me to. If you note in your email that you'd like to remain anonymous, we'll sure respect that. So don't hesitate to communicate with us. That's how we learn, by listening to you. We have a fabulous show today, but before we get to it, let me make a couple of quick announcements. Number one, we have agreed to sponsor and put on a content management series. And this is a fabulous series of shows that we're going to be starting in our Tuesday segment, 1 o'clock on Tuesday, starting August the 2nd. And if you'd like to be apprised of these shows, if you'd like to participate in these shows, we would love to have you be on the program. Call in, send an email. Just listening in, if you'd like to get the live link, send me an email, radio@mytechnologylawyer.com, and I will sure send it to you. Our legal tip of the week has to do with how do you go about evaluating whether or not you should file your legal claim. Let's say you've got a legal claim and you're a little bit hesitant about whether or not you want to light the fuse on a lawsuit or an arbitration. What criteria do you use to figure out whether it's a good idea to move forward with your claim? Well, if you'd like to know the answer to that, go to past programs, July the 20th. We've got our legal tip of the week. It's an 8-minute audio file where I answer that question. It's a live audio recording from a past show. It's part of the CD-ROM that we have available, Things You Should Know About Litigation. It's just one out of 20 questions that I address on that CD-ROM. If you'd like to see the whole CD-ROM, you can go over to mytechnologylawyer.com/TECHLIT, Tech Lit, and you'll see that CD-ROM available for sale. It doesn't cost anything to listen to the Legal Tip of the Week. July 20th, it's labeled Legal Tip of the Week. You can listen to the audio file. You don't have to be a subscriber or a member. Stories from the Technology Page will air again tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Hillary Clinton, it turns out, demanded that the FTC probe this question of simulated sex on Grand Theft Auto, and in fact, the game's rating has been changed. What are the political ramifications for Hillary Clinton's victory on this issue when it comes to the next presidential campaign? I'm going to tell you all about it tomorrow at 1 o'clock, so be sure to tune in to Stories from the Technology Page. When we come back, we've got our Geek of the Week, Hugh Wright, San Jose, on the line. Don't go away. Listening to MyTechnologyLawyer.com. Cyber terrorism is a fact, and it's here to stay. But that does not mean your systems have to remain vulnerable. Find out how to protect yourself by tuning in live at 4 p.m. Eastern on July 21st. Dr. Andrew M. Kolarik will be here taking your calls and talking about his new book, Managerial Guide for Handling Cyber Terrorism and Information Warfare. So be proactive. Do something about arming yourself against cyber warfare. Start your education about this important threat by listening in on July 21st at 4 p.m. Eastern, right here at mytechnologylawyer.com/radio. Yeah. Welcome back. You're listening to MyTechnologyLawyer.com. This is your host, Scott Drahn. We have our Geek Report of the Week. This is a third in a series of six, and our geek this week is Hugh Wright, who is located out in San Jose, California. Beautiful country out there. And welcome to the Geek Report, Hugh.
Thank you, Scott.
Now, I understand you're a new geek. Tell me all about it.
Yeah, I am. I started just at the beginning, or I'm sorry, the end of May, beginning of June. We opened for business here in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Oh, wow. What a gold mine. What a gold mine. Now, how's it going so far?
Well, it's going pretty well. We see a lot of growth. We're just getting off the ground, getting the word out there. Very exciting times right now.
Yeah, I think, well, you're standing in good stead now. I think, as I recall from the Geek show that we did, Geeks on Call has about 300 franchisees, do they not?
Yeah, they have about 300 franchise territories, that's correct.
Yeah. So you got a lot of people to help you out, and if you've got questions, a lot of references you can make, so that's pretty fabulous. Now, of course, the question of the week is, what indispensable software tools are needed by every small business, and how do they work? So give me your take on this question.
Sure, Scott. I think the most important thing, first of all, is to make sure that you're running an operating system on your computer. That's certainly essential. Most of us these days run Windows XP, either home or professional. And I think which one you pick is really going to depend on how big your office is, how big your business is. If you have a really small business like a home office or just a couple people, you're probably going to run with home. If you have a larger business, you'll run with professional. In addition, today it's just absolutely essential that you have an internet browser and you have some way to handle email. Whether you do that through your internet service provider or you do that through Outlook, but you need to have some form of email.
Well, let me stop you right there.
Sure.
In your territory, right there in the Bay Area where you're focused, what are you typically seeing in terms of the operating system, in terms of the choices people are making in your territory? When you show up, what do you find on the computer?
Well, I think most of the time we find people are running off our XP home. Sorry, Miss. But we do have some larger places. We walk in there, and they're running XP Professional, and it really is a matter of the size of the business and what kind of network they're running that determines what they're going to have on their computer.
Yeah. Do they get you involved in, recommending changes? You ever show up and you say, hey, you got XP Home, you really ought to think about XP Professional because, this and this factor, it might work better for you?
Actually, Scott, I think what we've found more often is we walk into a home or a small business that's been running maybe an older version of Windows, and we try to recommend that they move up to XP Home or XP Professional.
Yeah. That doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
Okay, and so you move to the next product. The next product you mentioned, one of the choices was Outlook, and that was for, refresh my memory again?
That was for, I meant Outlook Express, but that's for handling your email.
I see. And is Outlook Express, is that mostly what you're seeing?
Yeah, we are seeing mostly Outlook Express, although a few people are using Outlook, I think because it does come with some customer relations management capability.
Are you finding that a lot of people in the field that call you, are they fully leveraging all of the capabilities of Outlook or Outlook Express, or are they only barely cognizant of what it's for?
I think most people, especially people running Outlook, are pretty fully cognizant of the capabilities. On Outlook Express, I think they're pretty much just running the email functionality. Outlook Express comes automatically with the software, whereas Outlook itself has to come with another package.
I see. Okay, what else do you recommend that you have to start with?
Well, you certainly are going to need to have some accounting software, either QuickBooks or Peachtree or one of those kinds of packages that you need to keep track of what your financials are for your business.
What are you finding in the field that most people have?
Well, you know, most people aren't typically calling us out for accounting software issues, so we really haven't really focused on what people are running in that case.
I see. So either QuickBooks or Peachtree would be your normal expectation.
Yeah, QuickBooks or Peachtree are my normal expectation.
What else do you want them to have?
Well, they ought to have some. They really need to have some at least a basic office suite. Whether they, you know, for example, Microsoft has Office XP or Office 2003. That's a package with Word and you know, a spreadsheet program like Excel, and maybe some presentation software. There are other Office suites available, but you know, most of the time, I think we're seeing people using Microsoft's suite.
And why do you think that is? Obviously, it's because of the popularity and the momentum and the install base that Microsoft has. Are people making a conscious decision to select those products based on functionality, you think, or is it because, you know, that's just kind of what's in front of them?
I think it's because it's what's in front of them. I mean, since almost everybody's running Windows, you know, the Microsoft operating system, I think they have a tendency to migrate to the Microsoft Office package as well.
Yeah. What about the media players? Is it your view that everybody's doing Windows now, or is Real Player still a force in the market?
Well, I certainly see a Real Player still there, still as a force in the market. People are, you know, electing to run Real Player. I use Real Player myself when I have a choice.
Yeah, well, here's my dilemma now. I'm a vendor, and I have mytechnologylawyer.com, and we have a lot of audio, video files, a lot of collateral material produced off of this show, and I'm still making my Windows media files available and the Real Media, Real Player files available, because I can't decide if I should go with one or the other. Can I risk now getting rid of my Real Player audio files and just go with Windows and still expect the same level of usage, or you think I will be truncating off a part of my market that I'll permanently lose?
Well, I think you'll be okay with just Windows Media Player, if you're a user, I still think you're going to want to have Real Player on your system, because there are streaming sites out there that run on Real Player.
Only. Really? I was not aware of that. Okay, if I'm a lawyer and I have my office at home, what else do I need? Is this everything I need?
Well, I think if you're a lawyer, you're going to definitely want to have some billing package, some billing software on your system.
What kind do you think I should get?
I hesitate to make any recommendation there, because I'll be honest, I'm not that familiar with the billing packages out there. I really haven't. That's not something I've really looked into.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I'm pretty familiar with all of them, and a lot of them are not too good. I can say that on my own show.
Yeah.
But I think that's a question that you ought to research very carefully and not overdo it. Just get what you need. So what's your view on that? If people, you know, you mentioned before that a lot of people buy Microsoft product because obviously Microsoft is in front of them. And there are resources out there for doing things like really checking out what time billing software you ought to use. And some people are very good and very thorough with that, while other people, you know, just sort of pick the first item on the list. What's your view of the competency level of the people out in the field that you talk to about making those choices where, you know, one major lead product is not self-evident?
My experience has been that most of those people are looking for somebody to come in and make a recommendation. In a related area, we do have a law firm that's looking for us to recommend a document management solution for them. Similar idea. There's not really one dominant package out there, and they're looking for someone to come in and help them set something up for their office. So,
I have no doubt that you are the man. All right, that's our Geek Report of the Week. Fine job from Hugh Wright. Good luck to you on your Geek franchise. I have no doubt that you'll be successful, sir. We will be right back.
If you thought you had to pay top dollar to engage a best-in-class law firm, think again. Drawn Legal Services has taken the attorney-client relationship to an entirely new level. With Drawn On Demand. Compared with yesterday's conventional wisdom, Drawn On Demand is faster, more convenient, and much less expensive. For one low annual investment, you get access to the renowned Drawn Legal team and our lightning-fast web-based resource library, designed especially for the technology entrepreneur. When you join Drawn On Demand, you have access to a growing network of over 2,500 subscribers around the world who can help you navigate your way to success. Drawn On Demand legal services cost just $2.95 per year. That's less than many attorneys charge for just 1 hour or consultation. Learn more about Drawn On Demand by visiting www.mytechnologylawyer.com. That's www.mytechnologylawyer.com.
Are you having computer trouble again? Hi, I'm Randy Brooks, and boy, do I know the feeling. This past weekend, my computer crashed again with another virus. I was on the phone with one of those computer tech support helplines. It was like 2 hours, and they still didn't get it straightened out. Then I go to the office this morning, and our brand new network was down. I was actually packing up the equipment and headed to the electronics store when my buddy told me about Geeks on Call. 1-800-905-GEEK, that's the number. Or you can visit geeksoncall.com. He said they'd send over a technician right away to help me out. Same idea as like a doctor making a house call. So I called him, and sure enough, they came in no time. It only took like 20 minutes, and the network was back online. So this weekend, they're installing a wireless network at my house and updating my virus protection. And check this out. Geeks on Call is going to improve the data security at the office and hook up my wife's computer for her home business. 1-800-905-GEEK. Look, take it from me. These geeks really know their stuff. 1-800-905-GEEK for Geeks on Call.
Welcome back. You're listening to MyTechnologyLawyer.com. If you'd like to be a part of our show, you can call in toll-free 866-685-7469. Or you can send me an email, radio at MyTechnologyLawyer.com. If you would like to get a free CD-ROM, Legal Questions Commonly Asked About Computer Security Issues, I'll be happy to send it to you, no charge. Just send me an email requesting the CD-ROM. If you're listening to an archived version of our show, as many, many people do, you can still get the CD-ROM. All you need to do is send me an email requesting it, telling me what the date is of the show that you listen to. And if you are a subscriber or member of MyTechnologyLawyer.com, I already have your address. If you are not, shame on you, you should be. But you can still get the free CD-ROM. You just got to be sure to give me the address where you want me to send it. I will even pay for the postage so the price is right. I have on the line with me Dr. Andrew Kolarik, who is the author, as it turns out, or one of the co-authors of Managerial Guide for Handling Cyber Terrorism and Information Warfare, a serious question, a serious issue, made even more particularly so as a result of the London bombings again this morning. Professor Kolarik, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Scott. It's great to be here.
Tell me a little bit about your background first so we can kind of get a perspective on your perspective, if you will.
Well, I've been using computers in some kind of capacity for almost 25 years. I'm an information security consultant. I'm also an author. I've written several books on security. I'm a technology researcher. I own a few patents. And more importantly, I've always been a teacher, a facilitator of technology.
A fantastic background for beginning to sort of get our hands around this question of cyber terrorism, which I think is very, very much misunderstood, separating the reality from the hype. Talk to me a little bit about your view of the question and the definition of cyber terrorism. What does that mean to you?
Well, first, I want to start with talking about terrorism, because this is where this term cyber terrorism has been hijacked by a whole lot of other special interests. Terrorism as opposed to warfare, is about creating fear. If you're not creating fear, it's not terrorism. Okay? And fear in non-combatants, more importantly. Everyday people just going to work or being in their homes or going to their schools. It's about making a populace so afraid that they give in or give credence to your particular political orientation or social agenda or economic change agenda, etc. Now, cyber terrorism is about the use of cyberspace and the whole global information infrastructure by terrorists. And the way that I understand this, essentially, it's about the communications and coordination between terrorist cells, intelligence gathering for potential targets, the dissemination of propaganda, recruitment efforts, because if you can have a website and you can show beheadings and all these explosions and people marching in line, you can get recruits, and also about fundraising, because if you can demonstrate that you can impact the world, then people will give you money to perpetuate those particular agendas.
Is it a money-making enterprise in the sense that, you know, it's one thing for someone who has a lot of money to have a political agenda and to feed the political agenda. I mean, we do that in this country. You know, Democratic Party, Republican Party members, they have a certain political agenda on a particular issue, and so they'll float the bucks necessary to do the advertising and the promotion. That's one element. That's not what I mean. What I'm getting at is that is terrorism, is the motivation for funding terrorism economic at its root? In other words, I'm trying to drive an economic reality. I want to change the status quo so that it will be more favorable to my business model so that I can make more money.
Well,
you see what
not,
I'm getting at there?
I don't think it's driven by economics. No, economics impacts your ability to gain recruits.
I see.
I think it is a, and it falls into two categories, and some of them blur between them. One is a political orientation, and the other is a religious orientation.
Mm.
And in fact, this latest extremism version of jihad appears to be more political than it is religious. So it draws on the religious believers to help facilitate it forward.
I see. I see. So when we talk about cyber terrorism, we're not exclusively talking about the destruction of information infrastructure or the use of information infrastructure to perpetuate fear. We're talking about both?
Yes. What we're dealing with is the use of cyberspace by people who want to cause fear, but also the use of cyberspace in enacting that fear, and not just by displaying videos. For instance, a lot of our control systems, such as electrical distribution, power plants, water facilities, railroad stations, etc., are controlled by what's called SCADA systems. And a SCADA system is essentially a monitoring and control utility equipment that you can remotely operate. If you were to be able to control these systems remotely, which is essentially why they were established, so that you wouldn't have to send a person out over, say, 3,000 miles of track, if you could control those, you could cause train wrecks, you could cause dams to open up, flood whole plains, you could shut off power grids, etc. So that's one element of cyber terrorism. Another element would be, say, the medical and pharmaceutical industries. Let's say that, Cleveland Clinic, I live here in the greater Cleveland area, and we have folks from Saudi Arabia and other Middle Eastern sheikhs who come here for heart surgery. Well, if you were able to get into the medical database before their scheduled surgery and, let's say, change their blood type, all of a sudden, that sheikh will die because they'll give him the wrong blood, et cetera, et cetera. So it goes beyond just the financial motivation. Although, without money, terrorism doesn't go very far. So there are criminal activities that are also tied to cyberspace to help fund all kinds of other illegal activities.
Seems to me that the dynamic that you described requires two essential elements, and I'm going to ask you your judgment about the extent to which they exist. Number one, that hospital system has to be accessible by the perpetrator of the crime, so the accessibility or the vulnerability of that system. And number two, and this is something I find a little bit puzzling, there has to be an operator. There has to be a certain level of sophistication to even know that that system exists and to be able to figure out how to get in there and make the change in a way that is effective and transparent to the user.
Okay. Well, let me answer the first part first, obviously.
Yeah.
Gaining access to systems. We now have a proliferation where we want people to be able to work from home or log in from other remote facilities to be able to continue to do their workflow. So remote access is being made available to large-scale systems.
Right.
If an intruder makes use of that vehicle, they're one step closer rather than having to be on site. That's one. And they could do this from anywhere in the world. The second half of that is you have to have some knowledge of the system. Well, most of these systems are unified now. They're large-scale producers that sell the same type of systems all over the world.
Does it typically take an insider, either with respect to the type of system or the hospital operation, does it take an insider typically?
An insider makes it easier, but an insider may not necessarily be an insider for the target. Meaning, let's say that I get a job at the hospital in Baghdad and I learn their system. Well, here I find out that that system is also the Mayo Clinic.
Ah, I see.
Now, I have an insider perspective and knowledge base, but I didn't get it on site.
So we may be our own worst enemy in the sense that we're exporting technology in order to help us with in order to make money off the industry. But in fact, we're creating a level of standardization and putting these products out there that are making us at least partially more vulnerable.
Absolutely. The more standardized and prolific a given system is, the more likely it is to be attacked by whatever means, whether it be a cyber terrorist or a cyber criminal or just a hacker / cracker.
Yeah. Okay, serious stuff. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about your book and some other typical risks we face when we build this infrastructure. You're listening to MyTechnologyLawyer.com.
If you have a question for Scott, send us an email using the Ask a Lawyer feature of MyTechnologyLawyer.com. Scott personally answers these questions by direct email to you at no cost. That's right, no cost whatsoever. This is one of those rare, once-in-a-lifetime chances to get feedback from one of the premier technology lawyers in the country. Get an answer to your question from someone who really knows the business.
Now there is a great new tool for short-term investors to grab hold of winning stocks with a single mouse click. Introducing the Investor 3000, the world's easiest stock picking software. For over 3 years, Investor 3000 has been picking winners every trading day, and you can download this proven investment tool right now at www.investor3000.com. Do it now, and you'll be picking winners in less than 5 minutes. That's www.investor3000.com.
Men, nothing takes it off like Noxzema medicated shave. Take it off. Take it all off. Nothing takes it off like Noxzema medicated shave.
How close you shave, the more you need Noxzema. Noxzema medicated comfort shave.
Are you looking for a fun career? Do you enjoy working with animals? Would you like to be your own boss? Hi, I'm Mark Drawn, president of AquaZoo Pet Stores, and we may have just the right franchise for you. AquaZoo is one of the nation's leading independent pet stores. Some of the benefits to owning your own AquaZoo include strong profit potential in a stable industry, extensive training, little direct competition, a franchisor management team with over 30 years of combined experience, a unique concept in an underserved market niche. Oh, and by the way, did I mention strong profit potential? If you would like to learn more about this exciting opportunity, visit us on the web at aquazoopets.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to MyTechnologyLawyer.com. This is your host, Scott Drawn. We're talking about cyber terrorism and the meaning of terrorism. We're with Dr. Kolarek, who is the author of this book. I have a copy of it sitting right here on my desk in the studio, and I have been looking through it the last couple of weeks in anticipation of this show, and I've got to tell you that it's called The Managerial Guide for Handling Cyber Terrorism and Information Warfare. And let me tell you what I like about it. It is a good management framework for understanding the problem and the vulnerabilities and the reasoning processes that you can go through to manage the problem. It's a fabulous piece of work. And how do they get the book, Dr. Kolarek?
Well, you can get the book several ways. You can purchase it direct from the publisher, which is Idea Group Publishing.
Which is affiliated with the Information Resources Management Association.
Yes.
And they have been on our show a number of times. They are great, great, great friends of MyTechnologyLawyer.com. We love those people.
And you can also get the book from Amazon.com. And there is a third way to get a nice little discount. Thanks to MyTechnologyLawyer.com, an agreement between them and Idea Group Publishing, we can offer a 25% discount to anyone who wants it if they go to my website, www.andrewkolarek, that's AndrewKolarik.com. And on my homepage, at the bottom right-hand corner, is a little genie with a link to pull up the discount form. If you fill that out, fax it to the publisher, take 25% off.
Wow. Isn't that nice? Okay, well, take advantage of that. Everybody likes to get a good value, and that certainly is very good. And this is a book that is worth getting. There's a lot of material out there on this topic. But this is a very responsible, thorough, in-depth, and understandable treatment. Let's go back to the question of typical risks. What are you seeing out there as the typical risk associated with information insecurity? What kinds of things are happening?
Well, the primary, I'd say the number one attack method are these worms and viruses that penetrate systems that should have been updated or patched on a regular basis. That's the number one way that infections come into networks and computers.
Is it your view that the perpetrators of those, I mean, the popular press sometimes makes the case that it is, you know, the 19-year-old kid with green hair in the back room who doesn't have a girlfriend who's perpetrating these things. And that, you know, I'm not necessarily suggesting that that fellow does not qualify as a cyber terrorist. I'm not suggesting that at all. But that is a very different characterization than the image of Osama bin Laden on Mount Sinai with a cell phone sticking out of his ear while he manipulates his laptop to wreak havoc on Pentagon defense systems.
Well, what I would do is I would make a distinction. A lot of these attacks are not necessarily cyber terrorism, but they are cyber attacks, whether they be for criminal intent, whether they violate the law of the various respective countries, et cetera. As far as them having girlfriends and living in basements, that there may be a tone of truth to that, but they're not the primary perpetrator of these attacks. I would estimate that there's perhaps a couple thousand very highly skilled computer people who find out what these breaches are in security, and then they create what's called a script, a small engine that allows anybody living in a basement of their parents with no girlfriend and a computer and an internet connection to then use this script, they're called script kiddies, to then attack systems that are vulnerable.
Wow.
So it's kind of a secondary process. So a few thousand people are actively creating these. They make them available out on the internet. People download them for free, and then they use them as an exploit to get up to a lot of monkey business.
So it's like a distribution chain. It's like the wholesaler and the retailer.
Yes, only the goal is not money, but the goal is prestige and ego. And, you know, a lot of these folks will go onto chat rooms and they'll go, hey, I just broke into so-and-so and so forth.
Yeah. Wow.
Now, that doesn't discount the capabilities of real cyber criminals or cyber terrorists. Okay. And the problem lies in that the government right now doesn't have a clear legal definition to distinguish between.
And the distinction between?
Well, between cybercrime and cyberterrorism.
Yeah.
So if you use terrorism as the motivator for passing new law, then it needs to impact terrorists.
Yeah.
Not just people who are monkeying around or out for financial gain.
And are we making any headway in terms of achieving any clarity between those two? Because I can see that that's a very tough distinction.
Well, my understanding of the distinction is one is simply a breach of law, and the other is the intention to create violence of some form. Not scare you, but actual violence. If we as a society, or even as a global society, do not delineate between the two. Now, if I send you a virus in your email and you get afraid, now I'm a cyber terrorist. And that's not the intent of what the legislators are supposed to be doing. So my delineation would be an act of violence in some form.
I see.
The use of an electronic computer attack resulting in violence would be the way that I would approach it.
I see. And how would you define violence?
Well, if we go back to the medical, changing a medical database, if we go to, let's say, changing somebody's judicial record to make them a criminal, there's been, you know, movies about this, that would create, in my perspective, a form of violence, because now the system is messing with you. If somebody uses your identity via electronic means to rent a truck used to blow up something, now that would be cyber terrorism.
Yeah.
And can you imagine how your world would change overnight if it was your identity that was used in an attack?
Sure. Is it your view that we need more government action on this, or is this a matter for private initiative?
I think it's a combination of the two. The first thing I think that needs to occur is a standardization of the computer crime law.
Yeah, and when we come back, we'll talk about how we might go about achieving that, because we've had some attempts, and they have been spotty, I think. We're listening to Professor Kolarik talk about cyber terrorism. We'll be right back. MyTechnologyLawyer.com.
There's an old business maxim that nothing happens until a sale is made. If you're associated with a technology-based business, Drawn Marketing Services can help you create a sales and marketing plan that will bring qualified customers to your door. Drawn Marketing Services can take you seamlessly from planning to execution with market assessments, distribution mechanisms, creation of sales and marketing materials, and advertising. Our pros are experts in the latest sales systems, including email and the web, and we have the connections to guide you to profitable client relationships in both the public and private sector. Drawn Marketing Services is part of the Drawn Professional Association, Florida's foremost provider of technology business solutions. Visit us on the web at www.mytechnologylawyer.com for more information. Drawn Marketing Services, www.mytechnologylawyer.com.
If you're a software developer, you know that a strong contract is the key to profitability. You've focused your best resources on coding and debugging your dream product, so it makes sense to connect with the best resources to help you write the deal. That's what MyTechnologyLawyer.com is all about. MyTechnologyLawyer.com specializes in technology entrepreneurs, and with our unique Drawn legal plan, you have access to all the tools you need to maximize the return on your software development investment. Browse our extensive database to pick and choose the contract terms most favorable to you. Consult with the renowned Drawn legal team to polish your work. And as a Drawn legal plan subscriber, you can even promote your product on the My Technology Lawyer radio program. All this and more is part of the Drawn legal plan, and it's available right now for one low annual price. Learn more by visiting MyTechnologyLawyer.com. MyTechnologyLawyer.com, the Internet's best resource for the technology entrepreneur.
Welcome back. You're listening to MyTechnologyLawyer.com with our guest, Dr. Kolarik, who is the author of Managerial Guide for Handling Cyber Terrorism and Information Warfare. And if you'd like to get a copy of the book, what's the website reference again, Dr. Kolarik?
www.andrewkolarik.com. And there are links there to the publisher, to Amazon.com, and also a discount form, 25% off, courtesy of MyTechnologyLawyer.com.
Oh, that's very kind. That's great. All right, so that's a special for the My Technology Lawyer radio listeners, and boy, we add value every day with the help of our guests. Let's talk a little bit about this question of standardization of the definition of computer crime and the definition of cyber terrorism. We have at the state level around the country, last count I saw was about 30 state computer law, computer crime acts. And that whole question of how to define computer crime is a very tough one. Can we achieve standardization with it, or is it just a little bit too broad to get our arms around?
Well, I think what we need to do is create a law that the first thing in the law that says at the federal level that says all the other computer crime law is now rescinded, and here's what the crime law really should be. And a lot of the crime law that I have read, the legislation, they leave a lot of openness.
Yeah.
Okay. For instance, if I have my laptop and a wireless card and I'm in my car and somebody else's wireless network is open and I access it, there's a case now, I think, in Florida where they're trying to establish a precedent that that is a computer crime.
Yeah.
Even though the technology automatically connects me to their network.
Yeah.
Or computer crime is considered a crime using a computer. Well, it's very hard to even operate in our society without using a computer.
Yeah. I think that is right. And the definition of computer is so broad as to include just your wristwatch.
Yes.
You know, so that is a tough one. That is a tough one.
But I think it's not outside our ability to standardize the law. But if we're going to standardize the law for enforcement so that everybody knows what they can and cannot do, then we also need to standardize the information that we're allowed to have access to. A good example is when you apply for, let's say, to rent an apartment, you give the landlord enough information to create your own identity. Well, what happens to that information? What happens if it's disclosed or sold? And how do you know if that occurs? And is there a shelf life for the information you provide?
Well, what do you think we ought to do about that?
I think the first thing we have to do is convince both the government and all of these self-interests that the information doesn't belong to them, that it belongs to us.
Yeah.
And that we get to decide what happens to it. And until we as a population decide to do that, we're going to continually have problems securing the information, regardless of civil liabilities and so forth.
Sure, sure. To what extent can the problem be addressed, if at all, by sensitizing the citizen to simply not give out the information or not disclose or be sensitive to the fact that when they do engage in a disclosure, they are balancing the advantages of disclosure against the risk with realistic cognizance of that risk?
Well, if you apply, let's say you admit yourself into a hospital,
right,
they give you all these forms that you have to sign saying you're not liable for anything they do with your information, or they won't admit you into the hospital. And that's in a response to law that says they're not allowed to do anything with your information without your permission.
Yeah.
So
actually, I never fill those out properly. And I think a lot of people don't, but you are right. I mean, people do go into a situation like that, and they start filling that stuff out, and they don't even think about the importance of the information or the security of the information.
In a moment of need,
right,
we do most whatever we have to get through it. And unfortunately, there's an organizational momentum to this process. So I think the first step is we have to create this public awareness that the information belongs to us, not them. And until we change that value in society, it's going to be very hard to keep these things from proliferating.
How would you go about changing that value in society? Would you be an advocate for suggesting that our ownership of our information is a property right?
Yes, I actually would. Unfortunately, as in a recent Supreme Court ruling about property, we no longer have absolute right to property. That the state has the right to determine when that property can be used otherwise.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there are some tensions between private ownership and public use. There's no question about that. It makes this whole area very difficult. When we come back, we're going to take a look at how vulnerable are we, and we're going to ask Professor Kolarek to speculate on the future. We'll be right back.
If you're an entrepreneur, you know that the biggest challenge facing any new business is finding investors who share your dream. Drawn Equity Sourcing can help. Despite the bursting of the dot-com bubble, there are still millions of dollars in investment capital available, and Drawn Equity Sourcing can help you find it. We'll connect you with the right resources to create a funding presentation that cuts through the clutter. And when you work with Drawn Equity Sourcing, you're taking advantage of our large network of technologists, business managers, lawyers, accountants, brokers, and other pros who have done it before and can do it again. Learn more about Drawn Equity Sourcing services at www.mytechnologylawyer.com, the web's foremost repository of information for technology entrepreneurs like you. Drawn Equity Sourcing Services, part of the Drawn Professional Association. www.mytechnologylawyer.com. That's www.mytechnologylawyer.com.
LA Design is a web painting company. They combine the art of intelligent web design with multimedia technology to leverage engaging content that helps you attract and keep new customers. The LA Design Web Design and Interactive Media Studio is in Eastern Europe, and they work with more than 20 U.S. companies. How do they do it? Find out by listening live on July 28th. We'll be talking to the founder of LA Design, Ellie herself, and she'll be taking your calls from Bulgaria to tell you more about her business and technology opportunities in Eastern Europe. This promises to be a truly interesting show. Don't miss it. Find out what's going on abroad. Tune in live right here, mytechnologylawyer.com/radio. Welcome back. You're listening to MyTechnologyLawyer.com. If you'd like to call in, you sure can do it, 866-685-7469, or send me an email, radio@MyTechnologyLawyer.com, and we'll get your question in front of Professor Kolarek. And be sure to tune in next week where we'll have Ellie Design with us from Bulgaria. She'll be talking about what the technology industry is like in Bulgaria and how she wound up with 20 U.S. companies for which she does services. She calls herself a web painting company. Isn't that an interesting characterization of what she does? A web painting company. So there's a big creative element in her design. So we're looking forward to that interview. I know she wants me to send her an outline. So if you're listening, Ellie, it's on its way. We've got Professor Kolarek on the line with us. And we can't let this radio hour escape without talking a little bit about solutions for business in this world of cyber insecurity. Share with us some themes that you think are important.
Well, my understanding, again, because I'm not going to claim to be the all expert, but...
Oh, come on, cut loose and have a little fun.
most businesses have a very simple set of things that they need to do, and I'm astounded at how many really don't. But the first would be physical security. Now that sounds kind of out there, but if you don't secure your computer equipment, access to various parts of your facilities, access to your terminals, if you don't take a look at your personnel who move freely throughout your organization, the securing of your backups, your duplications and servers, etc., You really have to have a good, solid physical security of your facilities, equipment, et cetera, before you can even consider the rest of it. Because I can walk into a place And if I can easily get to your computer, I can unscrew it and walk out the front door with it.
Sure.
Everything else is useless. Now, the next area would be electronic security. And this is where you have to maintain the fundamentals of information security, which is confidentiality, integrity, authentication, access control, auditing, accounting, and non-repudiation. The storage of your data needs to have all of these controls placed upon them. Transmissions of that data, whether internal or external transmissions, communications, access control to those resources, maintaining the availability of those resources, etc. And this leads to things such as business continuity planning. What happens if you have a fire? Well, but we backed up the server, I hear a lot of people say, but they didn't take the backups off-site.
Yeah.
And now if you don't have your data, customers don't wait anymore. They're not going to, well, it'll take a week and then we'll get to it. No, they find other people who will deal with them now.
Right.
On top of that, there are systems out there that let you remotely be up and running within a few minutes by simply moving to another building or going home and using your home computer to go into the backup system. So business continuity planning, and that falls under identifying your critical assets, not just the data, your backup systems, and the remote operation. Those are the primary areas that I would focus on. And there's numerous more laid out in our book.
Yeah. Well, you know, computer security has become big business in the last 2 to 3 years, in particularly since 9/11. There was an initiative afoot, and we've got a lot of product out there. What's your view about its effectiveness? Is this a situation where we don't have the tools, or is this a situation where we've got tools, but we're just not to a point where we've achieved implementation? The organizational culture is such that we're just not implementing the tools we have.
Well, I think it's a combination of what they call a piecemeal approach. We need encryption, so we'll apply it here. Well, that's fine, but I can access it over here. There's also the people aspect.
Mm.
Bruce Schneier, who's a very famous writer in cryptography, said very clearly in his latest book, he said that most of these problems in security are based on people systems. People do the craziest things.
Yeah.
Through ignorance or deliberate act, people are the weakest link in this process. So by good security training awareness to make use of these tools and be made aware that they can acquire tools to secure a certain operation, I think that's the critical aspect. And then, of course, when you do have all these tools and systems and equipment and devices, we don't update them. Within 6 months, things are obsoleted. Software, hardware, cryptography keys need to be regularly changed. There's a maintenance aspect to security that most companies don't attend to.
Yeah.
At least not in a timely fashion.
Sure. So it's not a risk that you can eliminate to begin with. You can merely moderate it, and you've got to keep at it in order for that risk to stay low. It is an ongoing management issue.
Yes, security is an evolving issue that's ongoing, because every time we create an innovation to protect us, somebody else creates a new innovation to penetrate us. And so it's a game. It's a continual game of one-upsmanship.
Yeah.
And if you're not diligent, that's when you become vulnerable.
Yeah. Well, we've got about 1 minute left on this show. I can't let you get away without asking you the question, what's your prognosis? We're going to win this war, or is it going to get away from us? What's your view? What's happening?
Well, I think that if we view this as our problem, not someone else's problem, on a collective level, we can win this. But the moment you think that somebody else will take care of it is when we'll lose.
Yeah.
So through ongoing, you know, just building the awareness that we have to step up, we have to do what we need to do to secure our system, that's the way to go.
Fantastic comments, fantastic show. If you'd like to learn more, send us an email, mytechnologylawyer.com. We'll be back tomorrow. 9:00.